Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always an absolute pleasure to welcome back into our studios Michael Schumacher, a longtime friend of WGTD and the morning show, dating all the way back to the golden age of Bill Guy, who created this program and hosted it for many, many years. He and Michael had all kinds of memorable conversations about different books that Michael Schumacher has written. And I've had that pleasure since Bill's death to speak with Michael about a host of different books. I think the very first one we talked about was a biography of the great filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola. And we've also talked about at least a couple of different books which stem from another fervent interest of Mike Schumacher's, namely the Great Lakes and some of the shipwrecks which have occurred on the Great Lakes over the years. And I mean, a lot of us don't stop to realize, but there have been literally tens of thousands of shipwrecks on the Great Lakes. And of course, they aren't all an enormous big deal in terms of any sort of drama and loss of life, although I suppose there's always some kind of drama associated with even the smallest of shipwrecks. But Michael has a way of singling out those stories that are especially compelling. And he's certainly done so with his latest book, which is called Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. This is an extraordinary story of basically a primitive barge that was caught in a horrendous storm on Lake Huron and sent to the bottom of the lake, and all but one of its crew perished. This is the story of the one man who survived under extraordinary circumstances. And I'm really glad Michael Schumacher can be here to talk about this fascinating book, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press, again called Torn in Two. Michael Schumacher, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks. It's always good to be here. Always enjoy it.
Yeah, glad to be having you here once again. Just a quick word. Did anything in particular prompt this interest of yours, this really ferocious interest in the Great Lakes and in particular in these dramatic shipwreck stories?
You know, I probably should have some professional explain that to me. But seriously, I've always had a thing about Lake Michigan. I grew up in Milwaukee, and my parents will tell you that when I was just a little boy, I used to beg them to take me to the lake. And we would go from time to time, and when we moved to Kenosha, I lived right near the lake, so I went every day. And I, to this day, for what it's worth, I go to the lake. If I'm in town, I will see Lake Michigan at some point during the day. I just am drawn to the water, and I don't understand why that is. But that's just the way, you know. I know others like me that are like that. There's a pull. You know, you're brought to the water. So there was that, and it was a natural, I guess, tendency to want to know something about the water and then to know something about the other Great Lakes, and I've seen all of them now at this point, because I've always thought the lakes have their own personalities. Mm. They behave certain ways. They have different configurations, of course, and the shipwrecks themselves are different on the different lakes. And so the more I started studying, the more interested I became in some of this. And as you pointed out, there's so many really noteworthy ones. I've now done the big three, the three largest ones that have gone down in the lakes. And each one of these stories is really compelling. It's hard to explain, I guess, what it is about something. Other than you hear the story, you know, or you read about it or something, you're going, that sounds pretty interesting, and you run with it.
There is something very visceral about a boat going down into the water.
Absolutely.
And even for somebody who has absolutely never experienced that firsthand, it is terrifying in its own particular way. And, of course, some shipwrecks happen almost in an instant.
Yes.
But in many other cases, it is, in a sense, a slowly played out drama of mm-hmm. sort of mounting horror. And I suppose in many respects, it's a scenario that is absolutely ripe for treatment in a book like this. On the other hand, Michael, one of the things that I think is interesting is that you are faced with the task of writing about something in which basically we know the end of the story right. before we begin reading. We know from the subtitle of your book yeah. that the Daniel J. Morrell sank. That's yeah. never a question.
Right.
And what do you consciously think about in terms of trying to describe a story like that in which you do not, in a sense, have available to you that sort of element of suspense
right.
if it were a story where we didn't know how it was going
to
end?
Well, there's two answers to this. The first part, or two parts to this answer. The first part is that, yes, they know. But it's like saying if you pick up a book about the Titanic, we're pretty sure it's not going to go well for that boat or that ship by the end of the book. And with the Wreck of the Carl D, I opened up the book with the first paragraph said the 35 men on board the Carl Bradley, none of them knew that within a half hour the ship would be at the bottom of the lake. And my editors go, well, that's a hell of a way to start a book.
Yeah.
But the other thing is with a book on the disasters is I seem to see them in themes. Mm. For example, and you pursue it when you're writing the book that way. The book about the Edmund Fitzgerald, Mighty Fitz, was a mystery. No one knows why that boat went down. It didn't issue an SOS, anything. 10 minutes before it went off the radar, the captain of the Fitzgerald was talking to a captain of a boat behind it, and they asked him how he was doing. He said, I'm holding my own. And next thing you know, it's gone. So there was a mystery. The wreck of the Carl D, the Carl Bradley did get off an SOS, and everybody in the Great Lakes knew that it had sunk in this terrible storm. This was a book about a town as much as a shipwreck.
I remember.
All of these people that were crewmen, I think it was around 28, were from or around the city of Rogers City, which is this little tiny, 3,600 people, if I remember the right. So it was about a town. Then November's Fury was about a storm, a hurricane, literally. It fit every single qualification for a hurricane on the lakes. And now this one is about a survivor. And so I've got a little spin on each one of the books that keeps it, for me, and I don't mean to sound flippant about it, but how many ways can you sink a ship? And so how are you going to make this different? Yet at the same time, the challenge is that I can't assume that any of these people have read any of my other books. So you have to make sure that you get the details in there. So it's kind of a challenge.
It really is, and I think you've met that really well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Kenosha author Michael Schumacher about his latest book called Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. It is the story of the sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and of the one man who managed to survive that terrible ordeal. Describe for us, Michael Schumacher, what kind of a ship we're talking about with the Daniel J. Morrell.
Well, the Morrell was interesting. It was built at a time right at the turn of the century, the 20th century, when boats were getting bigger and bigger. All of a sudden, there was this explosion in making them longer. They put, originally on these Great Lakes boats, the pilot house was in the middle of the boat. And you had hatches on either side of it. Well, they stretched these things out. They put the pilot house in the front end of the boat, the engine house in the back, and in between it was like one big floating warehouse. And the sizes of these things were dramatically changing. The Morrell was one of the early 600-foot boats. Now, to give you an idea of what that means, that's two football fields long. It's a big boat. Now we have 1,000-footers out there, but this was a really big one. And, you know, it was, as a boat, it was just a big, like I said, like a warehouse. They'd load usually iron ore into it. It would haul it down to some steel firm somewhere and head back up, or it would pick up something like coal or something and drop that off, you know, on the way back to where they were getting their next load.
So this is not a fancy boat, and it's not doing anything fancy. It also, if I recall correctly, was a relatively old boat at the time that this sinking occurred. Just kind of tell us about how sort of the state of a boat like this would be tested. And, I mean, if whether or not a boat like the Daniel J. Morrell was fully seaworthy at the time that this accident occurred.
Well, it's funny because the way it was tested, and this was tested, it had been tested a couple of times, in fact, that season, and was deemed seaworthy, even though, you know, the people on board were going, well, this baby's getting up there. The one thing they did not test much of until after this accident was the metal. When the older boats were built, they used a different kind of material, you know, metal, which was turned out to be very brittle in cold water. And so a boat, after years of service, it was like bending a paperclip back and forth and back and forth. Mm. It's twisting and turning, which they were built to do in these storms, but it took a little toll on it. They didn't really know the significance of that metal. In 1948, shipbuilders started using a different, sturdier metal on the construction. So everything prior to 48 had this possibility. And the Morrell, having, you know, been on the lakes for 66 years,
right?
It had seen some storms, and it had been beaten up, and it, I'm sure, run into the docks, you know, and so forth, the Sioux Locks or whatever. It had taken its beating. It was judged, however, to be seaworthy.
Right. And I suppose what we're talking about then, if the metal itself, in a sense, the integrity of the hull was perhaps compromised in this way, it's not something that would have been apparent to the naked eye. I mean, we're not talking about like tearing of the hull or the big bolts, you know, coming loose or anything like that. Yeah. It would have been the integrity of the metal itself, and that was something they weren't, sounds like, not really testing for at the time. It probably didn't even occur to them.
The only time that this matters, really, and this sounds kind of sarcastic, and it's not, but the only time it matters is if the ship sinks. You know, these guys will tell you, and I've had the opportunity to interview, I don't know how many people have worked on these boats over the years, they'd pop a rivet, which was very common. They'd be, you know, rivets down on, below decks would be flying all over the place. You didn't even want to be out in it. It was like being shot at when these things were twisting. They'd just stick a piece of a broom handle in there, saw it off, that'd hold it together till they got to port, and they'd replace it. You know, the ways they'd say, well, the ship was leaking. All ships leak. It's how much is it leaking? But when something like this occurs, and this was very significant because its sister ship was out at the same time, in the same area, in the same storm, and it started to crack in the same place. The captain didn't even know it till he got to safe harbor, but he notices a crack going right across the deck the same way it did in this. So it tells you something about the construction of these boats. If it's happening under the similar conditions, the same, and like I said, a sister ship. The only difference between the two ships was the sister ship was 1 foot longer.
Wow. So the Daniel J. Morrell in 1966 is subjected to an especially ferocious winter storm. First of all, just say a word about Lake Huron. That's kind of perched atop there.
It's very much like Lake Michigan. It runs north-south, which means when you get in the fall, you get a nor'easter. Those can be pretty nasty Because especially if you're going down the lake, you'd think that you would want to be in that position where the waves are behind you. Actually, you're better off going straight into the storm, into the waves, than away from them, because those things would come behind you, and they roll up your deck. They would lift the ship out of the water. The propeller would spin, and then as soon as it was slammed back into the water, it would send a tremendous shudder through the ships. It's tough.
Mm.
And this particular storm was by no means the worst storm that Lake Huron ever saw. I wrote about that one in the other book, because that was the big daddy of all the storms on the lakes. But it was a nasty one. It was nasty enough that the captains of both of the boats, the sister ships, sought safe harbor, you know, shelter. The night before the morale went down, they literally dropped the anchor, just waited for a little while, and when it seemed like it was okay again, back they went out. It's important. The morale was to remember that the morale was in the big storm that brought down the Carl Bradley. It was out in that.
Mm.
And the Bradley storm was worse.
Hmm.
And the morale handled it. You know, so many of these sailors have told me over the years, if you don't have any faith in a boat, get off. He said, most of them will tell you they feel as safe in a boat as they do on land. So with the morale, the complaint, like everybody complains about their work situation. Well, this boat's really a piece of crap or something. But they feel very stable on it. And there was no indication whatsoever through any of the inspections that there was anything to be concerned about the morale other than its age, of course. And you can't make them younger.
Hmm. So this brings us to kind of an interesting point then about the severity of this particular storm and what happened to the Daniel J. Morrell, the fact that only one man survived. So in terms of a lot of what you talk about, in terms of what happened to the Daniel J. Morrell, even before we get to the story of this one man's survival against all odds, I assume he is just about the only person you could turn to,
exactly,
in order to get this information.
Well, I did talk to people that went out looking for them, you know, some of the members of the Coast Guard and so forth. They could describe the storm, but they couldn't obviously describe what Dennis Hale, the survivor, could, what it was like to be there. I've always been really fascinated by one little aspect, and it's kind of silly, but you're on the boat. The boat's broken in half, or it's in trouble, whatever. And you're up there on the deck, and you realize in the middle of this ferocious storm, you're going to be down there in that water sometime real soon. Dennis is standing sitting up on a life raft where it was supposed to break away and float. He's sitting on a life raft wearing nothing but his boxer shorts and a pea coat. The boat broke in the middle of the night when he was sleeping. He grabbed what he could, and he got out there as quick. He had no shoes or any pants, anything.
I remember them saying it was pitch black.
Yes.
I mean, he couldn't see anything in terms of trying to find anything he might want.
At first, he couldn't even figure out what was wrong with the boat. And then he looked down, you know, the running lights are on. He's looking down, and all of a sudden, the running lights disappear. And then all of a sudden, they reappear. And he's going, oh, no. That meant you'd broken the keel. That the boat was literally breaking in half. And there was no discussion as to whether or not this boat was going to sink. It was going to sink. It was just how fast.
Mm. This is probably a good time for us to talk about how you even crossed paths with this Dennis Hale, the single survivor, and to what extent you were able to talk to him about what happened to the boat. First of all, describe sort of the coming together of the two of you, and first of all, how you even knew about him and his story.
I learned about the Morrell actually back long before I wrote the book, and actually before I'd written any book about shipwrecks. I was aware of it. Dennis and I met at the 50th bell ringing service, or 50th anniversary bell ringing service for the Carl Bradley up in Roger City, Michigan, which would have been in 2008. And he was there as a guest because at these services, for people that don't know, What they do is a survivor or a member of the crew, you know, something who was invited, somebody who was invited, would go up. They would call out the name of one of the people that perished, and that person's family member or whatever would go and they'd ring the bell. Mm. It's a very moving service. And like with the Fitzgerald, they ring the bell 30 times. For 29 people that died on board the Fitzgerald, and one final one for everyone else that ever perished on the lakes. And they did that with Bradley. And Dennis was there. And my book had just come out, and Dennis was kind of interested in it. And we met and we talked for quite a while. We got our pictures taken together and all this other stuff. One of the things I love about these books is you're not talking about extraordinary people. Hmm. You aren't. And I've said that's one of the things that attracts me to this kind of story is that what you have here are just regular blue-collar, you know, working stiffs who get caught in circumstances that are way beyond anything they could have imagined. And, you know, their lives, their day-to-day lives, there's nothing exciting about them. I remember one time being on a radio show in, I think it was Cleveland, and we were talking. There was a guy with me who was the son of one of the people that died on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And one of these callers calls up, and he's taking the call. And they're going, now I know everybody thinks Fitzgerald was this big, grimy, grungy, you know, floating, you know, piece of tin out there. When in fact, it was the guy who goes, no, no, no. Let me tell you, I was on the Fitzgerald many times. It was big and it was grungy. And there's nothing sexy about this, in other words. And it was a beautiful boat by those standards. And so was the Morel. When it came out, this baby was a beauty. Hmm. And it set records for tonnage. It did a lot of things in its time on the lakes.
It was a workhorse for six decades.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And it's worth remembering.
Right. You know? And the kind of men who were a part of its crew over the years were, you know, in a sense, made of the same sort of stuff.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Right. So the Daniel J. Morel goes out in this really, really terrible storm. You recount that the captain evidently had some doubts. And do I remember that he was quite a young man and relatively inexperienced?
He was relatively young.
Yeah.
There were people certainly on his crew that were older than him. I honestly don't remember his exact age. I want to say he was in his 40s.
Oh, okay. Well, he'd been around,
you know,
a bit.
He'd been, but this was the first year he'd been on the Morel. I think that's important to remember. He hadn't seen how it handled storms. Hmm. These captains get used to, oh, the old girl, as they like to call it, the old girl's all right and this, and I saw he was shaking off the water like a dog shaking off a bath, you know, and they'll say things like that because they're used to it. Well, he wasn't.
Hmm.
And that's not to say that he would not have gone out if he knew what it was. It's not to say that this would not have happened. That's just to say that, you know, it's like when you buy a new car or something and it's making strange noises and you're going, what's that?
Right.
Type thing. And so he was out for the first year, and this was probably the first major storm he'd been in.
Right. And you recount different radio transmissions with the captain of another similar ship out in the very same storm. They're kind of comparing notes. And not long after the last of those conversations, the Daniel J. Morel, as we gather from the title of your book, is torn into two pieces by this incredible storm. In fact, describe to our listeners one of the strangest things about that, the difference between the two halves of the Daniel J. Morel.
Well, it was essentially torn when waves, very mountainous waves. We're not talking about the things we're seeing by the shore here. We're talking about 20, 25-foot waves. Would come under the boat and would lift it, and then it would let it down. And what you're doing is you're testing the metal, you know, with all of that. It's bending and taking a real beat. They call it pounding. And with this particular one, when it started, it broke very, very quickly. It tore, that's how Dennis described it to me. It was like tearing a piece of paper. It literally tore. And it did it very quickly. The back end, the stern portion of the boat, stayed lit under full power because that's where the engine is and where everything. And it literally went off eventually into the night while these guys were all in the water from the bow section, which was not, it did not have any power at all. The breaking apart had severed the electrical lines to the front, so they couldn't even send out an SOS. That was one of the things that happened after this. One of the new safety features was there were going to be battery-operated radios as well on board these boats. But when Dennis was describing being in the water and looking up and seeing, here's your boat the way you've never seen it before. You're looking into a torn-off section, and you're seeing, you know, the cargo hold and everything else as you would, you know, a model or something.
Right, in a museum maybe.
Yeah.
But here is in real life, your own boat. You're seeing the other half of your own boat. And this other half completely propelled.
Yeah.
Still moving through the water.
The bow section sank. They figure, or Dennis figured, in a matter of like 7 to 8 minutes. You know, you really were moving fast. It's so funny because when they tell you the story, like when Dennis tells you the story, he's trying to get everything in there, but by getting everything in there, it sounds like this took a long time. It was moving at lightning speed. And, you know, he didn't have much time to consider what was happening to him before he was in the water. He was tossed off. The raft was tossed. The boat rolled, and everybody was in the water. Unbelievably frigid water. This is the end. This is November 29th. You know, this is after Thanksgiving.
Right.
And they're in this incredibly cold water with, there's a raft in there, but, and it was lit. But how do you get to it? A lot of these men couldn't. Oddly enough, one of the things that I've always found interesting about sailors is how many of them can't even swim. They don't know how to swim. So they're wearing life jackets, and you're not going to last long in that water in a life jacket. But Dennis got on board the raft with three other people. So at least he was out, or he wasn't submerged in his cold water.
Right. And, of course, what ensues from there is the story of his own survival, even as these other three crewmen, one by one, succumb to the cold. I wonder, this brings to mind the question of what it was like for you to be talking with Dennis Hale and having him recount particularly this part of the story, which involved the slow and, one presumes, painful death of his crewmates.
It took a lot out of him, I'll tell you that.
These were his friends.
This was his family, that crew. Dennis had a real rough life in a lot of respects, and the crew of these boats was his family. And he took this very, very hard. When he was on that raft, it's funny, when you tell the story so many times as he did over the years, for a period of time after, you know, he was rescued, he didn't want to talk to anybody about it. But then he started talking about it, and then he'd go on like a lecture circuit and all this. When you've told it that many times, you lose a certain attachment to it. It's like you're telling a story that you're a character in, but you kind of lose this attachment that you had perhaps the first time you told the story. He always would get very emotional talking about the crew. He loved those people. One of the guys that died was a close friend of his, and he'd go over there. They'd go over to each other's houses for, you know, cookouts and things like this, and he took that very hard. And he took it especially hard because the guy's widow didn't understand, why are you still here? And so, you know, there's a lot of that he still contended with to his dying day.
survivor's guilt.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Right. One of the things you tell us about in this portion of the ordeal is how Dennis Hale at least one point, maybe more than at one point, suffered what we presume were hallucinations.
Yes.
or visions. And at least one expert has suggested to you that this might have had something to do with his survival.
Right. Well, there were several hallucinations, specific and distinct. The first time, he was very thirsty, which is kind of funny when you stop and think about it. Here he is in the middle of one of the largest freshwater bodies in the world, but he had no way of getting it.
Mm.
He was so weak, and he had no anything to pick it up with, the water. And so what he started to do was, it had been snowing, and he had ice all over his coat. And he's picking the ice up and eating it. And all of a sudden, at the end of the raft, this apparition, this old man, appears and told him to quit eating the ice. And I mean it. Don't eat any of that ice. It's not, you know, you'll die. So he quit. And in between that one and a similar hallucination, well, let me give you the second one first, the second hallucination. He finally gave up. He was so thirsty, he finally gave up. And he started eating the ice again, and the man was back. And he said, I told you, if you eat that ice, you will lower your body weight and you will die of hypothermia. Now, he had no way of knowing this. Dennis had never heard such a thing. So he thought of this as a very spiritual experience.
This is God telling
him. Yeah, somebody's telling him something pretty heavy.
You're going to get too cold if you continue
and
to
that
eat
was
this ice.
That tells you something, regardless of the nature of the hallucination, about the need to survive. And then the middle hallucination was he was lifted off of the raft into the air, very high into the air, and whisked to this place. Call it heaven, call it whatever, nirvana, whatever. And he met a bunch of people there who let him into their land, so to speak. And in the land was the front end of the Daniel J. Morrell. As it had been when he saw it last, when it sank. And there were his friends there, and he was he's overjoyed. My friends, my God, you know, da, da, da. And as he stood there, the stern section that had gone on into the night appeared in the distance, and it kept coming toward it till it joined the bow section, and the Morrell was one again. Now, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not going to try and understand what some of this significance is, but he met his friends from the rear section. And it was this great thing. He was with the people that mattered the most to him. And one of the people from the engine room says, what are you doing here, Dennis? It's not your time yet. And he was, all of a sudden, he was back on the raft in real life, blah, blah, blah. And the doctor thought these were significant developments. It gave him reason to fight on. It gave him a sense of purpose, a sense of his being. And he said, you cannot, you know, underplay the importance of that.
Right. Describe the raft he was on and what he had on that raft to help him survive. I mean, and the answer to that, of course, is next to nothing.
Not nothing. Well, when they got on board the raft, the four men, there were some flares, you know, shoot to indicate where you were, other boats in the area or whatever. There was what they call a sea anchor, which you can throw off. It's not going to hold you in one place, but what it's going to do in heavy waves like that is stabilize the boat a little bit. There, I don't believe, I may be wrong, but I don't believe there's any food on board. But the flares, there were two different kinds, one that you hold in your hand and one that you shoot out of a gun. Excuse me, and the gun broke, so you had to hold the gun together to fire these flares. Well, they fired some pretty early because they were told there were boats in the area, and nobody saw them. And then all of a sudden, it's like we better save a couple of these for later. And they put them. I think it's. I should mention for your listeners that the boat went down. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. So, you know, you knew you were in for a long night on the lake. Nobody's going to see you out there. No, the naked eye couldn't possibly see. It's hard enough when you know something's out there, and you're looking. I remember one of the captains telling me that. He said, "You get on." He said, "What if you saw something? What if you thought you saw something? How are you going to get to it? How are you going to, you know, in this weather?"
Right, and how do you even remember where exactly was
exactly.
that?
Exactly. It was crazy. They did see one body at one point, and they couldn't get to it. It just, you know, it goes blowing past you, and that's that. So it was one of these things these guys had to just settle in, and two of them didn't even make it through the night.
Right. And the third barely, but succumbs shortly thereafter. Well, Dennis Hale ultimately is rescued, and the story of that is quite interesting as we read in your book. And the story of his survival is really quite interesting as well. We've touched on this, I think, already briefly, but the fact that Dennis Hale, throughout much of his life, had been, in some respects at least, a somewhat troubled man.
Yes.
In some ways, a little bit of a screw-up, bounced from job to job and so on. And in some respects, being the sole survival of the Daniel J. Morrell was not necessarily the easiest thing for him to experience. How did he end up weathering the experience of being the sole survivor?
He knew something about survival, for one thing. I think that's one of the points I'm trying to make with some of Torn in Two, incidentally, was not just the boat, it was Dennis.
Right.
And so, I mean, his mother died giving birth to him. His father could not raise him, and he shipped Dennis off to a relative, to an aunt and uncle, and they weren't very good. They were pretty bad, including a very abusive, both physical and sexual, abusive older brother, well older, that Dennis had to. And all of this is important, I think, because you see he was predisposed to somehow getting by under impossible circumstances. And afterwards, the survivor's guilt was probably his biggest problem. But as far as determining who he was, he had survived. He'd run away from home. They'd bring him back. He'd run away from home. And when I say run away from home, I'm not talking about 2 blocks away.
Yeah.
I'm talking about cross country when he was just a kid. And so he knew something about survival, being on the street, so to speak, survival, doing whatever it took. And so this was obviously unlike anything he ever could have dreamed of, but the mindset was there.
A final question. Dennis Hale actually, you tell us, did a little bit of writing about this himself. I mean, I'm sure with the assistance of somebody else, wrote at least one small book about his experience, maybe two. What were you trying to do with your book, Torn in Two? In a sense, what aspects of this story had maybe not been told as fully or effectively in any of those earlier efforts?
Well, in Dennis's, he wrote one very, very small book. It was only, I don't know what, about 70 pages. And it was just about the wreck, and he had ghostwriters working with him on this thing. And then the second book was longer. It was self-published, and had some of the issues that those have, that covered more of his life, as well as the morale. And what I wanted to do with this book, what I try to do, first of all, with any of them, is get as complete a picture as possible. I included the Coast Guard report. I try to get as much as possible, because these boats, these shipwrecks don't have huge stories. You're not going to write a 800-page epic about this. And I wanted to look at it from a stand back and view position, which Dennis could not do. You know, Dennis was connected. Now, his story, the events that happened don't change, but the take on it might. You know, and then getting on with the rescue efforts, Dennis didn't know anything about that, and he didn't cover that much. Where I gave it a fair amount of attention in the book.
And it's quite interesting, actually, to read about the extent to which that kind of operation is undertaken, and it remains no less than a miracle that he was ever found under those circumstances. He died last year. I'm sure you have regrets about that he can't see this completed book.
He was a good man. I liked him. You know, he had his flaws, a number of them, but so do we all. And, you know, to me, I would have loved to have seen what his take was on the book. I think he would have liked it. I feel pretty confident in it.
Well, you certainly treat him with respect, even as you kind of share with us all that made him a complicated human being. And certainly you've done a fantastic job of sharing with us an absolutely riveting account of this drama as it played out on the stormy waters of Lake Huron back in 1966. So that's an anniversary then, isn't it?
Yeah, this will be the 50.
Yeah, wow. The book again is Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. A marvelous book, yet another marvelous book from Kenosha author Michael Schumacher. The book is published by the University of Minnesota Press. Michael Schumacher, it's been just great to talk with you again.
It's
and congratulations on an absolutely terrific book. I absolutely loved every page and look forward to talking with you about your next book whenever that appears.
2 years from now.
Ah, all right.
Actually, well, there's one next year, but I edited the book, so it's not my own solo work.
Well, we'll look forward to the next visit whenever that occurs here on The Morning Show. And thanks again for being here today.
Thank you.
Here's part two of today's morning show. Finishing out today's morning show will be a portion of the conversation that I recorded last week with best-selling author Jennifer Chiaverini, who is in Kenosha tonight for an event at the Northside Kenosha Public Library, an event that will run from 6:30 until 8 p.m. There she will be signing copies of and discussing her latest work of historic fiction, a novel called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. In this novel, we come to know John Wilkes Booth through the eyes of four women who were important to him: his mother, Mary Ann, his devoted sister, Asia, Lucy Hale, the daughter of a U.S. senator, and a woman presumed by many to be the love of Booth's life, and finally Mary Surratt, one of four conspirators in the Lincoln assassination, hung for their crimes. At the start of our interview, I asked Jennifer Chiaverini to explain why someone who obviously loves history so much and loves to do extensive research doesn't simply write works of nonfiction, straight history, if you will. I asked her what draws her to the genre of the historic novel.
Right. Well, that's true. I do a lot of historical research when I'm writing my novels. I love to delve into primary sources such as journals and letters and memoirs that my characters wrote. And it's true, I could have put those together and written perhaps more of a straightforward biography. And that would certainly have a lot of value. I think it would certainly show us a lot about John Wilkes Booth and his life and the people around him who were his family and friends. But one of the things that I love most about writing historical fiction is that it places the reader into the eyes, into the mind of whoever the narrator is. In my case, I had four different narrators, plus John Wilkes Booth in Fates and Traitors. And I think that by really immersing yourself in the fictional character's perspective, it allows the reader to witness the events as they might have unfolded to that person. And I think it really encourages the reader to develop empathy and more understanding, not only for the narrator, but for the times and places that person observes. John Wilkes Booth was, after the assassination, the most hated man in America, someone very difficult to understand or empathize with. But I thought that by coming at him from this angle, from these perspectives, it would help us to maybe understand him better, even as we absolutely deplore the act that he took on that fateful Good Friday evening in 1865.
Right. I have to say, I just finished reading the portion of the book that is in which we see John Wilkes Booth through the eyes of Mary Surratt, who ultimately was convicted of being among the conspirators and actually one of the four people hung after the president was assassinated. And I was really, in a sense, amazed and even a bit shaken to find myself sympathizing with her as much as I did. That is, with somebody who hated the North and hated abolitionists and hated President Lincoln and all that he stood for. And I really never thought that it would be possible for me to find myself in that kind of place, actually empathizing with and even feeling sympathy for somebody who saw the world as she did. I wonder to what extent you found yourself, in a sense, sort of amazed by that possibility, even for yourself as you wrote this book, that you could come to feel sympathy for someone that in so many other ways is utterly unsympathetic to most of us.
Right. And that's the great challenge to all of us in our daily lives, isn't it? To try to understand the point of view of someone whose beliefs are so entirely different from our own. This was a very challenging chapter to write, trying to really understand and portray in an honest fashion beliefs of someone who are so entirely antithetical to my own. Of the four women who I use as my narrators, she was the only one who shared John Wilkes Booth's Confederate sympathies. Like him, she was a Marylander. She had one son who was off serving in the Confederate Army, whom she had not heard from since he set out with his regiment, and whom she worried about every single day. And she had another son who was working as a Confederate courier, carrying secrets from the North through enemy lines to the South. So that is one place where I was certainly able to sympathize with and empathize with Mary Surratt, because as a mother myself, I can certainly identify with her concerns for her children and her fears for their safety. So I think even with someone like Mary Surratt, I can find places where I can find common ground, where I can find areas where, you know, we're not so different here and here and here. So even though I could never share her ideas about Abraham Lincoln, she despised him as a tyrant, I consider him someone I admire almost more than anyone else. And I certainly can't, I think secession was a mistake. She thought it was a great thing to do, and she prayed for its success every day. Certainly we don't at all share the same views on slavery. That is something that I could never condone. But by finding the things that we do have in common, then that gives me a place to start. And also, as a writer, I never want my characters to just be flat caricatures, to just be stereotypical villains. So that was really my task when writing not only about Mary Surratt, but also about John Wilkes Booth. It would have been very easy to just make them a cartoon villain. But then they wouldn't breathe. They wouldn't be alive on the page for my reader. And so that was absolutely essential that I find a way to make these people that I disagree with on a great many issues real and alive for my readers. And that meant treating their beliefs as they would treat them, as something that was sincerely come by and something that had been with them for perhaps a long time.
Jennifer Chiaverini's latest historic novel is called Fates and Traitors, a novel of John Wilkes Booth. She will be signing copies of the book and discussing it in an event at the Northside Kenosha Public Library tonight from 6:30 until 8 p.m. And we want to mention that Boswell Books will be on hand selling copies of Jennifer Chiaverini's wonderful book at tonight's event, free and open to the public, beginning at 6:30 p.m. Support for The Morning Show comes from